One morning, a young lion was striding through the jungle, feeling pretty good about himself and looking for trouble. The lion strides up to a nervous little zebra, roars, and demands to know who is the king of the jungle. Trembling, the zebra says, you are, sir, you're the king of the jungle, and don't you ever forget it, the lion says. Next, the lion confronts a little chimpanzee, roars, and demands to know who is the king of the jungle. The chimpanzee, freaking out, says, you are, sir, you're the king of the jungle, never forget it. Next, the lion walks right up to a huge elephant, roars and demands to know, who is the king of the jungle? The elephant looks down at him, wraps her trunk around him, lifts him up in the air, whirls him around and smashes him into the ground. Dazed and bruised, the young lion gets up, brushes himself off, and says to the elephant, you don't have to get violent just because you don't know the answer to the question. In that story, at least for this morning, you and your dreams are the lion. And the elephant represents the circumstances of your life. Circumstances have a way of grabbing hold of our dreams, whirling them around, and smashing them in. You remember, do you not, that famous line in the movie Titanic? Where Jack Dawson is standing at the bow of the ship and spreads his arms wide, looks to the sky, waves crashing around him. He's feeling pretty good about himself and he shouts, I am the king of the world. But we all know how that turned out. Life has a way of dashing our dreams, so that's what we're going to talk about today as we launch into a new sermon series on the life of Joseph as told in the book of Genesis. The Bible devotes 13 whole chapters to the ups and downs and the twists and turns of the life of Joseph. An amazing life, 13 chapters of detail, because there is so much spiritual wisdom that we can glean from Joseph's life and apply to ourselves so that we too can experience amazing lives. So let's dive in, but first a prayer. God, we know that these great stories of the Bible have been written for our instruction. We are hungry and thirsty to learn so that we can make the most of the gift of life that you've given us, so that we can live fully into your dream for us. Our hearts are open. Speak, Lord. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. The story of Joseph begins with these heady words. Genesis 37:5, Joseph had a dream. Don't we all? But first, let me back up and share a little background information. At the time of today's Bible story, Genesis chapter 37, Joseph was 17 years old. He was the youngest at this point of 11 sons of Jacob. He was the baby in the family. How many of you, when you were growing up, were the baby in the family, the youngest in your family? Aha, aha. The rest of us hate you. Because it's the baby in the family that almost always gets spoiled rotten, and Joseph was no exception. In fact, the Bible bluntly tells us, Genesis 37:3, Jacob loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age. And so Jacob gave Joseph his famous coat of many colors. As a fashion icon myself, I can really appreciate that right? Joseph was styling. He had his special coat, but not just that. Because you see, his dad would often send his 11 brothers out into the fields, his 10 other brothers, he was the youngest of 11, would send his 10 other brothers out into the fields to tend to the herds while keeping Joseph back at home. Son, there's no need to get your hands dirty because you are daddy's favorite. And needless to say, Joseph's brothers came to resent this. And then came the final straw. Joseph had a dream that he shared with his brothers. Genesis 37:6, he, Joseph, said to them, his brothers, listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly, my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brothers were not amused. His brothers said to him, are you indeed going to reign over us? So they hated him even more because of his dreams. Imagine when you were young and growing up, if your kid brother or sister said to you one morning, hey, I had a dream last night, and in my dream you bowed down and worshiped me. How would you have likely reacted? You probably would have dragged your baby brother or sister into the bathroom and given them a swirly. You know what a swirly is, right? Where you dunk somebody's head in the toilet and flush it so that the swirling of the water gives them a swirly hairdo. In fact, that's how Joseph's brothers felt about this dream and their younger, dreamy brother. But for his part, Joseph was feeling pretty good about himself. You can just hear his daddy saying to him, son, when you grow up, you can be anything you want to be. The sky is the limit. And Joseph believed that. Joseph dreamed that he, when he grew up, was going to be a king. And the world was his oyster. And many of us can relate to that in our lives. Because when you're young, you have lots of dreams, right? Think back to when you were Joseph's age in high school. What was your big dream? What were you going to become? Somebody tell me. When I was in high school, I was going to become a
veterinarian.
A veterinarian.
Crime scene investigator.
A what?
Crime scene investigator.
Crime scene investigator. Somebody else.
Supreme Court justice.
A Supreme Court justice. When I was in high school, like Kyle, I was going to become a professional basketball player. But it soon became apparent I wasn't going to be tall enough nor skilled enough to do that. So then, in high school, my dream was I was going to become the next Billy Graham. And when that didn't happen, I got stuck with you guys. Life has a way of dashing our dreams.
Ouch.
You got that. Good for you. You're tracking with me. Joseph was no exception. Shortly after he had shared his dream with his brothers, one day his father sent Joseph out into the fields to check on his brothers, seeing him coming from a distance. His brothers decided that this was their chance to get rid of this brother from another mother, which, by the way, was another dynamic happening in this story. This was their chance to get rid of their little brother. And so they decided they were going to kill him and tell their father that a wild animal must have attacked him and dragged his body away. So when Joseph reaches them, they seize him and throw him in a pit. As they continue discussing the best way to do away with him, they look up and on the horizon they see a trade caravan approaching and headed south toward Egypt. It occurs to them, rather than killing their brother and having blood guilt on their hands, far better instead to sell him as a slave to the passing caravan. And so that's what they did. He who would become a king had now instead fallen to the lowest socioeconomic rung in culture at the time. He had become a slave. Oh, how the mighty are fallen. And many of us can relate to that as well. Dreams dashed. And not just the dreams of our youth, but in every season of life, we have dreams about what could be, about what is possible. And in every season of life, life has a way of dashing so many of those dreams. You finally get your dream job only to discover that it's a living hell. You marry the person of your dreams, but it ends in bitter divorce. You move to a new city to make a fresh start, to make a new beginning, but the same problems follow you there. A child is born, your child, and you see the potential of that child, and you just know that that child is going to have such a wonderful life, but then they start making bad choices and veer off course. You finally reach retirement, and you're ready for your golden years and to kick back and relax and adventure and to travel, and life is going to be good, but then suddenly you lose your health. And that dream is dead too. Life has a way of wrapping its trunk around our dreams, lifting us up, whirling us around, and smashing us into the ground. There was an episode of This American Life on PBS where Ira Glass described how he had, was once addressing a group of about 100 people. And he asked those 100 people to think back to when they were young adults, first formulating the plan for their life, the fate that they just knew fate had in store for them. I referred to this as your plan A. Then he asked these 100 people, by a show of hands, he asked, how many of you are still following your plan A? Of 100 people, guess how many of them raised their hand? Any guesses?
Two.
Two?
Zero.
Zero?
Two.
One. Only one of 100. And she was. It's not a competition. But you did win. Only one of 100, and she was 23 years old. This past week, I found myself thinking about a dear friend of mine in college. I was the best man in his wedding. I remember when in college he first met his soon-to-be wife. He was so in love. She was so in love. When he would talk about her, he would rhapsodize. They were going to get married. This was the dream marriage, the dream woman in his life. Not just that, but he also had another dream. We were in Bible college, and he was majoring in education. His dream was to become a teacher in a Christian school, to mentor kids, to teach them. He loved that. He was passionate about that. And so when he graduated, he married the woman of his dreams, and he landed the job of his dreams at a Christian school. He was feeling pretty good about himself. I am the king of the world. And boy, was he passionate about teaching. He would pour himself into those kids. When he would tell me stories about his students, he would light up. In fact, sometimes he would send me examples of their work product that he was so proud of. And when a kid in his school had a problem, he was there for them. What a great teacher. He was created to be a teacher. But then he got crossways with the principal of the school, who also happened to be the lead pastor of the church that sponsored the school. And he lost his job. And in the process, he lost his church. And in the process, he lost his active faith. And as the years unfolded, his dream marriage also started to fall apart. They never divorced. They're still together to this day. But for recent decades, they've been alienated from one another, barely speak to each other. She spends money like there's no tomorrow, puts it on the credit cards, runs up debt, but she won't work, so he's now working. He's never again worked as a teacher. Instead, he's stocking shelves in a big box store. And there's a part of me that just wants to cry out and say, it doesn't have to be this way. It's like he's given up. It's like he's just listlessly going through the motions of life, mailing it in. There's a part of me that wants to say, it doesn't have to be this way. As followers of Jesus, this is not how we deal with broken dreams in our life. Okay. So how should a person of faith respond when we encounter broken dreams? There are, I believe, two core lessons that we can learn from Joseph's example when his dream was smashed into the ground. Joseph was sold to the passing slave caravan, carried down into Egypt, and there at auction he was sold as a slave to Potiphar, who was one of the chiefs of the guard of Pharaoh, a commander in the Egyptian army. He who would be king was now just a lowly entry-level slave. And how did Joseph respond to that? He became despondent, listless, just going through the motions, mailing it in. Right? No, that's not the story. In chapter 39, we're told that when Joseph was sold as a slave and carried into the house of Potiphar, he responded to his new lot in life with such gusto, with such optimism and confidence that God was still with him, that Genesis 39, verse 2 tells us the Lord was with Joseph and he became a successful man. He was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper. So Joseph found favor in his sight, and his master made him the overseer of his house and put him in charge of all he had, so that all things considered, Joseph's life was looking up again. He was feeling pretty good about himself again. His dream had been dashed, but he wasn't taking it lying down. He was moving forward with faith and with confidence. And there's such an important lesson in that for each one of us. It would have been so easy for Joseph to have become angry and bitter, angry at his brothers, angry at himself, angry at life, angry at God. Life had stripped away everything from him, everything he had, except one thing. There was one thing that life couldn't take from him: the power of his spirit, God's spirit in him. Joseph refused to yield. He refused to become despondent. His reaction in this story reminds me of an anonymous quote that goes like this: the most important thing in life is not what happens to you, but how you react to what happens to you. So that when life dashes our dreams, I've got a choice: resent, resist, and be miserable, or accept that I'm not in control, embrace what is, and move forward with optimism and confidence that God is right there with me. Because you see, experiencing fullness in life begins with accepting that I am not in control. That's so important. So let me say it again. We begin to experience fullness in our life when we get to that place in life where we accept that we are not in control. It is great to have dreams, but hold your dreams lightly, because you never know what's going to happen next. We were reminded of that last Sunday in the 11 o'clock service when I was in the middle of my sermon and the front doors of the sanctuary suddenly burst open and little three-year-old Huxley came racing across the front of the sanctuary, making a beeline for the instruments because he's fascinated with musical instruments. And then the doors popped open again, and in run his two aunts, Aunt Victoria and Aunt Nancy, chasing after him. It was like a scene from a cartoon chase, you know. Here comes Huxley running across the front here, and here come his two aunts running after him, and then Mom comes through the back doors running for him, absolutely mortified. But hey, he's just a kid. He was just being a kid. Life happens. And we can get all bent out of shape. Or we can smile and say, isn't life fascinating? You never know what's going to happen next. And then after Huxley was corralled and order was restored and I resumed my sermon, lo and behold, 15 seconds into the resumption of the sermon, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed that, oh my gosh, one of the candles, one of the prayer candles had burst into effusive flames. Because you see, when you light it with that lighting stick, sometimes the end of the stick will break off and land in the candle holder. It then catches on fire and superheats it. And I've seen it happen before. It can cause that glass casing to pop and make a big sound and create a mess. And so we've got a small fire taking place over here. So I have to interrupt my sermon again to go over and to blow it out. You never know what's going to happen next. And you can get all bent out of shape about it. Or you can smile and say, wow, isn't life fascinating? You never know what is going to happen next. Joseph, when he encountered this complete disruption of his life, he went with it. He made the most of it. He believed that God was still with him and that something beautiful still lay ahead of him in his life. And so he kept moving forward. We, as people of faith, living a life of faith, it's kind of like surfing. If you're a surfer and you think you're in control of the waves, you're going to end up being mightily frustrated and hugely miserable. If you're a surfer, your job is not to try to control the waves, but rather to ride the waves. And that's what we see Joseph doing in our story when life defeated him, when life ripped away his dream. Joseph didn't give up. Joseph didn't try to control what he couldn't control. Joseph surfed the waves. This is the first key of two key lessons we can learn from Joseph's example when he encountered bitter disappointment in his life. When a dream dies in your life, remember, accept that you're not in control, stop fighting the waves, and start riding them. Take whatever life serves up and make the most of it. Because if we respond in faith, believing that God is with us, good and wonderful things lie ahead. Because we know we are not alone. Jesus said, "Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." We know I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. We know all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to God's purposes. That doesn't mean that God is causing all of these bad things to happen, that God is necessarily the one who's breaking all of these dreams. God has given us and others around us the gift of free will, and that means there are going to be a lot of things that happen in this world that God doesn't want to happen. I do not believe for a second that God wanted Joseph's brothers to sell him into slavery. But that's what happened in this world of free will. And Joseph, at that point, had choice. Resist, become bitter and angry, or embrace what is and make the most of it, trusting that God was going to be with him and carry him forward. Which choice are you going to make in your life? Are you going to resist the waves? Or are you going to ride the waves? As most of you know, there is, our church publishes a daily devotional on Facebook, a daily meditation written by different of us in the congregation. This past week in the meditation I wrote, I told the true story of a woman named Sarah Darling. Sarah was walking along the sidewalk one day in the city where she lives when there was a homeless man holding a cup for people to put money in. So as she passed by, she stopped and she put some money in the cup and then walked on. It was only a good bit later when she realized that her diamond engagement ring was missing. She racked her brain trying to think, where could it have gone? What could have happened to it? And she had no idea. Meanwhile, not long after she passed by that homeless man, the homeless man noticed, oh my gosh, there's a diamond ring in my cup. So he took it out and put it in his pocket. And he waited until the next day. And sure enough, as she was passing by, he flags her down and says, Is this your diamond ring? She was blown away and overwhelmed with joy, so overwhelmed that she gave him all the money that she had on her that day, thanked him profusely. But then she went on, out of her gratitude, to create a social media site where she invited donations from strangers who wanted to reward this homeless man, Billy Ray Harris, for his great good deed that he did for her, and that site really took off, and lots of money was donated that she then passed along to Billy Ray Harris, but also she ensured that he got some good financial advice and other counseling, and all of that led to a news story on the local TV station. And it just so happens that a member of Billy Ray Harris's family saw that TV news report. His family had been looking for him, searching for him for years, couldn't find him. They'd heard rumors that he had died. But one of the members of the family saw that local news story and through Sarah were able to get back in contact with him, and they had a joyful reunion, and he's now, and they are now learning to live together, love each other once again. And in the local news story, Billy Ray Harris said, When I think of the past, I think, thank God it's over. I mean, I feel human now. Now think about what happened in that story. There is no way that Sarah Darling ever could have imagined or envisioned what happened there, right? Through a random tragic circumstance, she loses her engagement ring. One thing leads to another, and in the process, she ends up having the opportunity to change the life of a homeless man. Literally change the life of another human being. That's rare. And when she gets to the end of her life and looks back on her life, that's going to be probably one of the most significant and meaningful things she ever had the opportunity to do in her life. And there is no way she could have ever imagined that she was going to do that. There's no way she could have dreamed that someday I'm going to lose my engagement ring to a homeless man, and he's going to give it back to me the next day, and then I'm going to create a social media site and raise lots of money, and I'm going to help him turn his life around and put him back in contact with his family. You can't plan that. You can't control that. You just have to surf the waves, baby, like Sarah, like Joseph. People of faith are surfers who ride the waves. This is the first of two key lessons we learn from the life of Joseph when he was confronting bitter disappointment, broken dreams. When that happens to you, accept that you're not in control and stop fighting the waves and start riding them. Which then leads to the other key lesson that we can learn from Joseph in this. Lesson number two, when a dream dies, remind yourself of the most fundamental pattern of our faith articulated by Jesus in John 12:24. Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Understand what Jesus is saying there, and you will understand one of the most foundational principles for living a life of faith. The principle being, for followers of Jesus, death is never the end. For followers of Jesus, when a dream dies, that is not the end of the dream. It's just an opportunity for something even greater to come into being. And so when a dream dies for a follower of Jesus, we stop and we say, "I wonder what's going to happen next. I wonder what good God is going to bring out of this." Jesus is, of course, the ultimate example of that principle at work. Jesus died on the cross. The dream was dead. The disciples had dreamed that Jesus was going to be the king of Israel, who would restore their nation to peace and prosperity. He was going to be the Messianic king, but then he was killed and the dream was dead. But 3 days later, God raised Jesus up again in a now new body, no longer a mortal body, but an infinitely better immortal body. And now the dream that had died was alive again, but in an infinitely greater form. Because Jesus was raised up not just to be the king of Israel, but to be the king of kings and lord of lords, who would redeem the entire cosmos. It turns out that God's plan B was infinitely better than the disciples' plan A. It sure is a good thing their dream died, so as to create room for something even greater to arise in its place. That is the basic pattern of the life of Jesus, and we are people of the cross. That means as followers of Jesus, we are called to embrace and repeat that same pattern in our lives again and again and again in aspects large and small. Romans chapter 6 verse 5 says, if we have been united with Christ in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. We are to take the pattern of Jesus in his life, death, resurrection, and replay it over and over again in our life, so that we become the kind of people that when something terrible, when a dream is broken in our life and other people seeing that say, oh, look at Jeff. Man, I think he's a goner. He's as good as buried and dead. So that when people say that about us, lo and behold, 3 days later, or 3 years later, or 30 years later, they see you again and say, whoa, is that Jeff? I thought he was dead and buried and gone for it. Look at him. He's thriving. How is that possible? The answer is, if we die with Christ. If we, like him, surrender control and embrace that we are not in control, instead embracing whatever is. If we ride the waves instead of fighting the waves, then we too, you and me, will rise again like Jesus. Again and again and again, we will rise like Jesus. Are you living the pattern? I mean, just ask Joseph. Joseph's dream was dead. He who would be a king had become a slave. But spoiler alert, in a few weeks, when we get to the end of this sermon series, we're going to see that Joseph's dream ultimately came true, but in a way and on a scale that he never could have imagined. So it sure is a good thing that his original dream died, so God could raise it up again in an infinitely better form. Let me close with this. It's a story I've shared with some of you before, but I believe it just perfectly captures what God's word is trying to teach us today. Back in the early 2000s, David Haidu was the music critic for the New Republic magazine. He tells how one evening he was sitting in a small basement club in New York City listening to a jazz combo playing. To the surprise of everyone there, this jazz combo, which was an obscure combo, nevertheless, Wynton Marsalis, the famed jazz trumpeter, one of the most famous jazz musicians ever, was there playing with that jazz combo just for kicks. His buddies were in the band, he was there playing with them. Everybody was even more surprised when several songs into the set, Marsalis stepped to the front of the bandstand and began to play an unaccompanied trumpet solo of an old 1930s song, I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You. Haidu says, as I sat there listening, it was as if Marsalis' trumpet was weeping with despair. And in his trumpet sounds, you could hear the gasps of the pain of the music. It was exquisite, a master musician at work. And then Marsalis came to that last climactic line. And Haidu says he began lingering on each note with long pauses in between. I don't stand a ghost of a chance. And he was about to hit those last two climactic notes with you when somebody's cell phone went off with an insipid cell phone jingle. Some people in the audience groaned. Some began to snicker. The man with the phone stood up completely embarrassed, raced out of the room with his phone. But Haidu says, as I was sitting there at my table, I scribbled on the pad, the notepad in front of me, magic ruined. Most musicians in that moment, with such an interruption, would have gotten completely frustrated and stopped. You're going to have to start all over again. But not Marsalis. Haidu says Marsalis didn't skip a beat. He simply replayed note for note that insipid cell phone tune. And then he played it again and again several times, each time with different accents. And then he played it several times more through in different keys, refining it each time, making it better. A master musician at work. It's at that point that everybody realized that they were witnessing something extraordinary. A master musician at work. And then Haidu says, Marsalis managed to weave that cell phone tune seamlessly back into the original melody of the song and came back to that climactic line. I don't stand a ghost of a chance. And then the last two notes, with you. And the crowd went wild because they realized that what they had just witnessed was infinitely better than if there had been no interruption. Life is meant to be like that. Life is not meant to be a classical composition where everything is all written out in advance and can be played with predetermined precision. Life is like jazz. You never know what's going to happen next. And so you have to be spontaneous. You have to ride the waves. You have to go with what is. You have to be prepared to improvise, trusting that God's spirit will inspire your spirit and something beautiful will happen. So, when you find yourself in a place of bitter disappointment in life, remember, if you die with Christ, if like him, you surrender control and embrace whatever is, and instead of fighting the waves, you ride the waves, then you too, like Joseph, like Jesus, you too will rise again. And you'll probably end up finding yourself saying, you know what? God, your plan B was infinitely better than my plan A. Dare to live like Joseph. Ride the waves.